my pleasure to introduce Seamus Hassan, the founder and president of the Beckett Fund for Religious Liberty, a bipartisan interfaith public interest law firm that protects the free expression of all religious traditions. Since 1994, Hassan and the Beckett Fund have successfully represented clients from nearly every faith tradition, including Christians, Jews, Muslims, Buddhists, Hindus, Native Americans, Unitarians, and even Zoroastrians. Along the way, the Beckett Fund has won kudos from thinkers from Pope John Paul II to Elie Wiesel. Hassan enjoys broad credibility in the national media. He's been widely quoted, appearing, for example, in Newsweek, U.S. News and World Report, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Wall Street Journal, the Christian Science Monitor, and USA Today. He's appeared on broadcast news programs, including The Today Show, Dateline NBC, The McLaughlin 101, NPR's Talk of the Nation, and CNN Talkback Live. He's also appeared twice on Al Jazeera, debating Saudi clerks. Hassan debates frequently in venues ranging from Oxford to the Vatican, and apparently right here in St. Louis, from Harvard to Yeshiva. He is the author of the interestingly titled The Right to Be Wrong, Ending the Culture War Over Religion in America. And today, we have him to talk about a fascinating topic, specifically whether the possibility of gay marriage has implications for religious freedom right here in the United States. So please join me in welcoming him to be our guest today.
Let's talk for a while about same-sex marriage and conscience. Conscience is a funny concept. It's something that's born and bred deeply in America. It has been ever since the good efforts of the Quakers from the 17th century on. But it's totally misunderstood, or willfully maybe misunderstood, in many sectors of the current conversation over same-sex marriage. So let me give you some history about where conscientious objection comes from. Those of you who are old enough with me to have had a draft number for the Vietnam War recall having friends who were COs. And some of us hated COs, some of us loved COs, but all of us thought being a CO, if it was sincere, was a respectable thing to be. It remains the same. People who are conscientious objectors from military service are perfectly respectable citizens who take a perfectly respectable position in America. It wasn't always the case. In the 1650, I believe, the Quaker movement erupted in England British Reformation continued to fracture. And there was a new thing. They didn't accept the authority of clergy. They didn't accept the authority of scripture. They accepted the authority only of something called the inner light, which they believed was God's direct presence and voice in their souls. And it was much more than conscience. It was God speaking clearly and infallibly to them. They had to obey at all costs. Now, when you get enough people together saying that God is talking to them directly and they can obey no other voice but His, interesting things begin to happen. Quakers were known to turn up naked at Anglican services shouting hypocrisy. And all this didn't go over well at all with the Puritans in New England. So the Massachusetts Bay Colony in 1652, before there were any Quakers in this hemisphere, outlawed Quakerism. And they provided a penalty that if anybody showed up as a Quaker, he or she would be thrown out. If they came back, they'd be flogged and thrown out. That didn't work when the Quakers finally made their way over here and got thrown out. The inner light said they'd come back. So they came back, and then the Massachusetts Bay Colony changed the penalty to flogging for a first offense. For a second offense, you would have your left ear cut off. For a third offense, you'd have your right ear cut off. For a fourth offense, you'd have your tongue bored through with a hot iron. And they enforced that in Massachusetts. That didn't work, so they opted to the death penalty. They enforced that in Massachusetts. So in 1657, Mary Dyer was solemnly publicly hanged on Boston Commons for the crime of preaching Quakerism in Massachusetts. The Quakers had a battle all through the colonies, but the Massachusetts experience was the worst. Where they weren't getting killed just simply for preaching their faith, they were universally in trouble for two things: not being able to swear oaths, not being able to join the militia. Swearing oaths was not the perfunctory exercise it's taken for today. In the 17th century, for all its faults, was nowhere near as jaded as we are. For them, an oath bound you before God to behave in such a way, such and such a way, or not to behave in such and such a way. And if you forswore an oath, you were in danger of losing your immortal soul. Thomas More, you recall, went to his death for refusing to take an oath he didn't believe. Quakers spent 100 years refusing to swear oaths and having their property confiscated, losing their cattle, losing their homes, going to jail, until somebody wised up and decided that people who were willing to go to jail and lose everything they had rather than forswear an oath was likely to be very trustworthy even regardless of them. And they began to make accommodations for them. One of which appears in the Constitution to this day, an oath or affirmation would be good enough to make one's pledge of allegiance, as it were, to the Constitution. The other thing was that military service was something that was impossible for the Quakers. And this was a much bigger deal than the oaths. Oaths are quaint little things as we look back on them. Just a sort of harmless kind of religious exercise that was a big show of accommodating. But refusing military service in time of war in the colonies was a very big deal. There were local wars all the time with the Native American tribes. And if the village were 50 men, no village, no colony, no political group had a standing army. It was just a militia, which was the military equivalent of a volunteer fire department. Everybody had a gun at home. And the alarm was sounded, you ran with your gun and your ammunition to the square and engaged in battle. Well, if 50 people or 50 men are in a good town and two of them are Quakers, that's 4% of the military force that can't show up, and that makes a significant difference and puts one's neighbors at greater risk. It's a big deal. They spent 100 years refusing to fight the militia. It wasn't until the American Civil War that they got any legal protection from it. In between, they were going to jail, they were forfeiting everything they had. In the Civil War, Confederate soldier named Seth Laughlin was literally hung by his thumbs for refusing to serve. He was facing the firing squad the next day when he asked for permission to pray. They thought, of course, he was going to pray for himself. No, he was going to pray for them. And he used the quote of Jesus and said, "Father, forgive them, they know not what to do." And the firing squad refused to fire. And that was the catalyst for the Confederate Army beginning to recognize conscientious objection. Lincoln being in the White House and being very friendly to Quakers was the linchpin for the North accepting it. And by the time the Civil War was over, a new category of military service had been created. You could show up and be a medic, or you could do something else, but you didn't have to go into battle, you didn't have to fight. And that's been the case ever since. Supreme Court in Vietnam expanded it beyond religious conscience objection to all kinds of conscience objection, philosophical. You didn't have to be religious, you just had to be. The phrase they used is that if this belief occupied the same place in your life that a religion would, if you're religious, then it counts for you, basically. Now, it's still a conscientious objection, though. it's worth asking ourselves why that is. Why should it be that if your conscience says you cannot kill the enemy, you get to be safe on the ground, whereas if you think it's war is just dumb, or too expensive, or you prosecuted poorly, they can make you fight? Well, if you remember Yossarian in Catch-22, this was his argument. Yossarian was a combat pilot who didn't want to fly in combat missions. And he continually went to his commander and said, I don't want to fly. And the commander said, why not? He said, they're trying to kill me. He said, well, they're trying to kill everybody. Yossarian's witty reply was, what difference does that make? And he had a point of sorts. By what right can the government force you to risk your life? And its commander had a point, too, that the state is under attack, all its citizens are under attack, and all its citizens can be summoned to repel the attack. But all citizens are not being summoned to repel the attack. Conscientious objectors get to stay on the ground safely. Why should that be? Why should it be that conscience entitles you to something that just the conviction that this is a dumb war, an overly expensive war, is not? The answer is conscience is special. Conscience is the core of who we are. It's our conviction that there are truths, and there are rights, and there are wrongs, and that we, as a human being, must live our life according to what we believe the truth to be, must do good and avoid evil as we see it. And it's simply putting weight on, putting value in that term of conscience that makes the equation make sense for why refusing to fight in time of war is a good thing. Now, why is all that necessary background to talk about same-sex marriage? Because same-sex marriage is something that a large plurality, if not a majority of Americans, believe they cannot be complicit in without violating their conscience. And it's see, it's just that simple. It doesn't quite do it justice. There are plenty of things that Americans are happy to give CO status to now. It's not just military stuff. You can forego vaccinations if you're a Christian Science scientist. You can be exempt from juries if you're Plymouth Brethren. You don't have to serve on juries in the Sabbath if you're an Orthodox Jew. You can wear your beard if you're a Muslim police officer in Newark. Thanks to us. Back to fun case. The plenty of things you can do, but when it comes to a cutting-edge social issue, the people pushing for the change seem conveniently to ignore consciences of the people who disagree with them. Same-sex marriage is where the rubber meets the road in this issue. There are, change the law of marriage to say, not just men and women, but men and women, is not just to change one law. It's to change hundreds of laws. It changes the tax code, it changes the insurance code, it changes the housing code, changes the health code, it changes public accommodations law. And it does it with one swell swoop, as it were, that does not take into account all the subtleties of what results from it. So for example, when Massachusetts changed law of marriage, say that same-sex couples could marry as well, all of a sudden it became arguable that Catholic colleges, Boston College for example, had to open its married student housing to same-sex couples as much as traditional couples. That's something that Boston College cannot in conscience do, I would hope. the poor wedding photographer out west who was conscripted to photograph a gay wedding against his conscience, was ordered to do the wedding under the public accommodation law of California, because it had been changed as well when they changed the law of marriage. All of a sudden, a wedding photographer refusing on conscience to be complicit in a gay marriage was denying a public accommodation on the grounds of marital status. The church camp in New Jersey was ordered to allow same-sex marriage on its property, was denying a public benefit on the grounds of marital status. The examples can go on and on. The ultimate end to this set of dominoes is when we come to, inevitably we will get there, the Bob Jones kind of case of same-sex marriage. Bob Jones, you'll recall, was the Supreme Court case in the 1980s. It held that Bob Jones University is a segregated Christian, private Christian university in South Carolina, that I have no particular sympathy for. Could not retain its federal tax exemption because its dating policy, not allowing interracial dating, violated federal public policy, therefore was not entitled to 501c3 status. Bob Jones defended on the Free Exercise Clause and said, this is our religious conscience, we must bar interracial dating. And the Supreme Court said, sorry, compelling state interest overrides your religious freedom, and therefore you lose your tax exemption. Now, it's not too far-fetched to imagine a situation where it's not Bob Jones, it's Notre Dame, and Notre Dame is barring same-sex couples from its married student housing. And they sued to get the tax exemption revoked. At least the federal government moves to revoke the tax exemption. The argument is the same. We have to do this because of our religious conscience. And the question will be, is there a compelling governmental interest that overrides your conscience to strip Notre Dame of its tax exemption for allowing same-sex couples, or barring same-sex couples, with married student housing? And there's no telling how that will come out. Some good arguments on the other side. And I'll certainly be happy to make them at the time. But there's no reason to suspect that there'll be anything other than a 5-4 decision against the Supreme Court, one way or the other. That, in a nutshell, is the problem. That when you do something as momentous as change the definition of marriage, you don't just change one law, you change hundreds of laws. And unless you make provisions for the conscientious objections of people and individuals, from the wedding photographer to institutions like Notre Dame, you're going to ride roughshod the religious liberty, consciences of majority of the population. So, Beckett Fund, my organization, does not take a position formally whether same-sex marriage is a good idea or a bad idea. The position we take is that if you're going to do it, you should do it thoughtfully through the legislature, not in a one-shot deal from the state Supreme Court. You should do it while carefully making allowance for all the conscientious objectors who are out there whose consciences are of great value to the American tradition, even as much as the right to marriage that the same-sex couples claim is valuable. Questions?
Was there something in the Iowa Supreme Court decision to try to accommodate this?
The Iowa Supreme Court decision, as I recall, basically said there'll be no forced solemnization. Nobody will be forced to officiate at a gay wedding against his or her conscience. The California Supreme Court made the same point. Well, that's a straw man. Nobody was ever going to be able to be forced. The core, the very core meaning of the Franchise Clause would always protect some priest or rabbi from not having to officiate at something he or she couldn't. That's not the question. The question is whether the wedding photographer has to be there, whether that's Columbus Hall has to be allowed to be the used for the reception, whether the florist has to provide the flowers. And those are questions that the courts, the recent courts to rule pure same-sex marriage, just refuse to acknowledge exist. Please.
I have kind of a wonky technical question about the wedding photographer case. I'm not sure if you're aware of the details of how this worked, but you alluded to the fact that the photographer was actually forced to take the pictures, which is kind of unusual. Usually courts won't order positive injunctions on people forcing them to do things because of the prohibition on slavery in the Constitution. Well, how do you happen to know how that worked, whether it was just some sort of, you know, either you do this or you'll have to pay this huge fine, and so it was effectively a positive injunction, or whether they actually issued this positive injunction forcing them to do it?
I don't know. I'm sure the answer is that, but I don't.
Okay.
It doesn't matter for the conscience of the guy involved.
No, it certainly doesn't. I'm just curious.
I can't imagine those were very good photographs. I can't believe they couldn't find one gay photographer in San Francisco.
If marriages went back to being contracts without the licenses, would the equal protection laws still apply in such cases?
Contracts enforceable by the courts?
Yeah.
Yes.
To what extent do states that already have civil union laws run into the same religious liberty problems that gay marriage would?
The difference between calling something civil union and calling it marriage may seem to be just rhetorical, but it's not. By making it a separate category, the equal protection arguments and the public accommodation arguments are not there anymore. So you're not discriminating against some marital status. So it's there's still some conscience objection things that would turn up, but nowhere near as much.
You say problems where maybe a gay couple, they want to join a church, and the church preaches against homosexuality, would there be a problem, a lawsuit or something of that sort?
Well, it only costs $20 to file a lawsuit, so there'll likely be a lawsuit, whether it's a serious one or not, I don't know. I think the Free Access Clause will be available. Let churches be churches. Other sorts of church entities, schools, hospitals, all bets are off. And I expect charges to their tax exemptions to be the main weapon of choice.
Sure. My question has to do with kind of your understanding of the proper application of the Equal Protection Clause. From what I'm gathering, you said that the general position taken by the Beckett Fund is that it would be inappropriate for a court to make a decision that says basically the state must sanction same-sex unions. And my general understanding of the establishment of the Equal Protection Clause is that not only that homosexuals might be able to claim status as a protected category, or at least a category that's traditionally discriminated against, even if there was no recognized protection for them as a group, the state would still be required to have a rational basis for refusing to join same-sex couples. Mm-hmm. And so I wonder, what rational basis do you think would be the best argument to say, here is a reason why two people of the same gender should not be joined?
Maggie Gallagher, who I think is the most articulate spokesman for that position in the debate today. And Maggie's insight is that it's in the government's interest that those who made the baby stay together to raise the baby. And that heterosexual sex always has at least the potential, ordinarily, is, you can imagine situations where someone's sterilized or something, has the potential of creating life, even unintentionally, even in situations where parties are trying desperately to frustrate that situation. And that in itself gives the state ample reason to regulate marriage between men and women. Gay sex, by definition, can never accidentally or deliberately create life, and therefore there's no reason for the state to extend the same level of regulation and privilege to their couples as the same as to opposite sex couples. I repeat, that's not my argument. That's Megan Gallagher's argument. And I'm not in a position to defend it particularly. But she makes it well. About 5 minutes, the perspiration will stop, the shaking will.
Do you know anything about the Vermont legislature's decision? Did they happen to incorporate any protections for people's individual conscience?
They did. Nowhere near enough in our estimation, but they did. And it goes beyond just solemnization. It touches on some fundamental things for religious organizations and churches in terms of their hiring and so forth. It's, again, it's very narrow. It's nowhere near substantial enough in our view, but it's a step in the right direction. Connecticut legislature this week, I understand, is considering a much more robust set of protections. Don't know how it'll come out.
So how could a state protect themselves from this kind of activity?
How could a state?
In other words, how could the people of the state promote something that would protect this kind of marriages between the man and the woman kind of thing without the Supreme Court or somebody else interfering and changing things? Is there a way?
Well, it takes a state constitutional amendment, apparently. The several states passed statutes that purported to define marriage in the state between a man and a woman. And the state Supreme Courts have struck down those statutes of the state constitution as an analysis of equal protection. When the state comes in and amends the constitution, as it did in Prop 8 in California, that trumps the state Supreme Court's decision. What remains to be seen is whether the federal Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court of the United States, holds a matter of federal equal protection policy. It's a funny way to say policy there, but that's effectively what it is. Equal protection analysis. But, same-sex couples are entitled to same treatment as traditional couples. That's the end game. I don't see the Supreme Court being eager to take that case anytime soon. Justice Kennedy, when he wrote an opinion in Texas for striking down the Texas ban on sodomy, was careful to say that none of this applies necessarily to same-sex marriage. Which is a bit like saying 2 + 2 = 4, but we're taking no opinion and saying no opinion away, 2 + 2 = 1 = 5. the logic of it was inescapable. In fact, I'll tell you, I was getting the Texas Attorney General ready for the argument, and I told him, I can't tell you what I told him. Many people wished that he would get up and confess error under the Fourth Amendment and say this was an outrageous search. They haven't raised the Fourth Amendment, it's an outrageous search under the Fourth Amendment. We should confess error under the Fourth Amendment rather than lose on the grounds that he did. Many people thought that was a good idea. He didn't think it was a good idea, so he didn't do it. Can't tell you what I told him to do.
Many of the state's Defense of Marriage Acts specifically define marriage as a union between one man and one woman. Has the Beckett Fund taken a position or thought about the implications of that for people whose religious practice might include plural marriage?
Yes, we have. In our view, Reynolds was an easy case to simply say Reynolds was the 1879 case that gutted the Free Exercise Clause at the time in the service of holding a ban on polygamy in the territory of Utah. I think the proper way to write the opinion was not the distinction between belief and action that the Reynolds Court chose, but simply to say, yes, this does impinge on the religious liberty of fundamentalist Mormons, but there is a compelling state interest in maintaining the Western tradition of the Western definition of marriage. And it's one man and one woman. I think there's plenty of argument, plenty of available evidence and social cohesion and what's good for kids and so forth to make that stick. So we were not interested in defending anybody's right to completely.
So in your experience, how receptive have courts been to arguments from, let's say, the Western tradition or any sort of tradition?
It varies. I think the key argument to make is that not that same-sex marriage is a bad thing. The key argument from our perspective to make is that it's such a complex thing with implications for vast quantities of people, vast numbers of institutions, places you never would have thought of. It just doing it by judicial fiat without sorting out all those exemptions is a really bad idea. The legislature should do it and do it in enough of a considered way that we think through whether we want a dragoon of law, a photographer into taking pictures, or we don't want a dragoon of photographer into taking pictures. That's the kind of thing that one court.
That would be like the arguments against the Equal Rights Amendment, that each in case of discrimination against women should be handled and not have some overall arching principle in the Constitution without taking into account all the nuances and implications.
Well, legislatures can take into account the nuances and just write a code. The court just writing an opinion and order is stuck speaking in primary colors and writing in broad strokes.
You mentioned the California case. I haven't kept up with that, but what's the basis that the constitutional amendment is being challenged?
The ballot initiative provision in California allows amendments but not revisions. I think it's the two phrases. And the challenge is that Prop 8 was not an amendment, it was a revision. It messed with the structure of the whole Constitution. It didn't just address one subject matter. My tea leaf reading, oral argument, which is always dangerous, is that there's not a majority for the proposition. Prop 8 will be fine. A 4-3 vote. And the retroactivity claim will not pass. So the ways that have taken place in California will remain valid. There will be no more. It's my best guess that's going to happen.
Do you foresee a possibility in the future where if the minister was to get up and preach against homosexuality, it'd be considered a crime?
It has been in California, it has been in Canada. We defended a pastor in Sweden. He was literally being sent to jail for Pastor Arthur Green for being such a homo. And the Canadian Human Rights Commission, I believe it's called, has fined all sorts of people for similar sorts of statements. And of course, you say it can't happen here because of the First Amendment. The question of all is what the First Amendment would be interpreted to mean. The Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, a couple of years ago, amended state crimes law to include animus against gays as one of the triggering subjects. And it went to great lengths to make sure of saying that harassment by communication is not part of this law. So you can harass people by communication and not worry about committing hate crime. And literally, the dead of night, 2 weeks later, they deleted that amendment. So now the law of Pennsylvania is you can commit a hate crime just by speaking a lot about homosexuals. And has not been tested yet. I'm confident that any reasonable thing said from the pulpit that was not burned down the gay bar will be protected under free exercise clause, the free speech clause. But I'm also confident that there are forces in Pennsylvania that are willing to put that to the test. That's unfortunate.
Had there been prosecution in Pennsylvania, there was in Pennsylvania, there had been some prosecution on the gay crimes where people were on the street at a gay pride gathering. Maybe it wasn't Pennsylvania.
Maybe. There's done with your speech. Again, the alarming thing is now free exercise clause or free speech clause might not suffice. I think it will, but that there's a large segment of the population out there that thinks it shouldn't suffice. That's where they test it. Enough of that.
I think so. Thank you very much.
boxes right now.
When we look for a plaintiff, look for the most telegenic, sympathetic person we can. So, for example, a couple of years ago, we had a case. It was a 12-minute slot on the Today Show. Zach Hood and his beginner's Bible. And Zach was a first grader who, his public school teacher said to him one day, "Tomorrow you're going to read in front of the whole class for the first time, and your reward is you get to read from your favorite book, bring in your favorite book." Zach brought in his cartoon beginner's Bible, wanted to read the story of Jacob and Esau. Teacher said, "Sit down and be quiet, you can't read in the public school." And believe it or not, the exact same thing happened in Indiana. First grader, the teacher said, "Tomorrow you read in front of the whole class for the first time, read your favorite book." He brought in his family Bible. So the kid in Indiana had on a white shirt, flood-tied pants, white socks, bad haircut, and had a big old family Bible under his arm. His parents were missionaries. Zach had a Pokemon t-shirt on, long hair, floppy socks, cartoon beginner's Bible. His mom was an artist. Which one are we going to pick? And we ate him alive on TV. Their lawyer kept saying, "Separation of church and state." And Zach said, "It was very, 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 I told more very sad." And the lawyer said, "Separation of church and state." And Zach's mom, shown in a studio painting, "I'm not trying to force religion in the public schools. I'm trying to force respect for religion in the public schools." So we just, I expect them to do exactly the same thing.
There's equal protection. I guess that's obvious in state and national constitutions.
Well, there's always the substantive due process argument that right to marry is a fundamental right. I think protection is the strongest. They don't want any protection. There's nothing more obscure than the right.